popular education radio. It's a quirky trip back, don't you know? For punks and nerds and curious minds, we've got history's hidden finds. Sit back and enjoy the show on Popular Education Radio.
Hello and welcome to Popular Education Radio. My name is Tammy, and today we're going to be talking about the summer of 1932. If that year sounds familiar, well, it's because it was during the Great Depression. During that time, approximately 17,000 to 25,000 U.S. World War I veterans, their families, and affiliated groups marched to Washington, D.C. for a peaceful protest. This was the Bonus Army, and they gathered from all across the country to demand an early cash redemption for their service certificate. The story of the Bonus Army underscores the power of grassroots organizing and tells what happens when people come together and fight for justice. In this episode, we'll dive into the origins of the Bonus Army, learn exactly what it was that they were demanding, all while painting a clear picture of the political, social, and economic circumstances of the time. We'll explore the systemic changes that followed the actions of this movement and examine the U.S. government's handling of the veteran activists. All this and more on Popular Education Radio. So while our story takes place in 1932, it's important to understand the chain of events that got thousands and thousands of U.S. veterans broke and destitute enough to go up to President Hoover and ask, or really demand, to be made whole again. See, the U.S. White House and Congress started to have a conversation about giving military bonuses to World War I veterans back in 1924. Although two presidents vetoed the idea, eventually lawmakers approved the military bonuses, although it was right before the Great Depression. And looking at the timeline, I assume they knew that this was coming, which is why they gave themselves time to defer the payments until 1945. While they did allow veterans to take out cash on credit, the U.S. economy was pretty much in shambles by 32, and banks couldn't even lend out money, mostly because they didn't have any to lend out. When I say the banks were not doing well in the 30s, I mean it. The USA was deep in the Great Depression, arguably the toughest time the country has ever faced. 4.3 million unemployed people, and by 1933, almost 13 million people were out of a job. Unemployment rate stood at 25%. In addition to over a third of banks failing during this time, farmers were hit with an additional crisis. Farmers in Oklahoma, Texas, and Kansas were dealing with a drought, which brought on a series of dust storms, also known as the Dust Bowl, cue Woody Guthrie. Sharecroppers in the South were being crushed by poverty, and black sharecroppers especially suffered significant amount of unemployment due to racism. All Americans were struggling, and a lot of folks were living in poverty, so the Hoover administration tried tactics to jumpstart the economy. Most notable of these actions was the founding of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, aka RFC. In 32, government gave the RAC the authority to lend out $2 billion of taxpayer monies to banks, railroads, and other privately held companies. In the same year, they appropriated another $300 million of the nation's first relief to public works projects. This might sound familiar, and if it does, it's because this was the first American bank bailout. See, Hoover thought that the federal government should not be involved in fixed prices on the market, controlling businesses, or manipulating the value of the currency. To him, even at the time of great distress in the nation, all of these seems like, quote, steps towards socialism. Even though Americans were asking and begging for government intervention, he still refused to use federal money or direct aid to citizens. He was quoted to say that the dole would weaken public morale and insisted and told Americans to focus on volunteerism to raise money. At the time, Louis McFadden, who was a Republican rep from PA, himself a bank president, said, and quote, Hoover's whole idea of an RFC assumed that a group of people, of wise men, could concern the U.S. economy clear enough to pick the right banks, railroads, and corporations to resuscitate with the right amount of cash. What we find instead is that when an appointed committee like the RFC is matched with a large amount of money, the results quickly become politicized. The RFC and Hoover's unwillingness to give direct help to the people ultimately cost him his presidency the same year and allowed for FDR to win by a landslide and would introduce a series of social welfare programs known as the New Deal. Before the actual march to D.C. in May, the political discourse around the Bonus Act itself was a heated one. It started when Texas Congressman Wright Patman authored the Patman Bill, or officially known as the Adjusted Compensation Payment Act, and this was the uniting point for the Bonus Armies movement. Passing this piece of legislation was largely the Bonus Armies' demand. If this legislation was to be passed, it would have authorized the immediate payment for the veterans' bonuses, which were originally scheduled to be paid out in 1945. The Bonus Armies movement aimed to pressure the government into passing this bill. The organizers of the movement hoped that their physical presence, marches, and sheer scale of demonstrations would sway opinions in Congress. The debate, which really started as a mere discussion of payments and budgeting in the halls of Congress, morphed into a broader public dialogue about government responsibilities, fiscal policies, and societal values during a period of unprecedented economic hardships. Advocates of the Bonus Army included Texas Congressman and veteran Patman, of course, as well as other Congress members with large veteran constituency, labor groups, progressive veteran families, and really the public at large, as shown in the solidarity and support that the traveling veterans received on their way to D.C., which we'll talk about in just a second. Just a reminder that while not all veterans made it to D.C. due to work or illness or worries of being labeled a communist, a large majority of people supported this action. Proponents of the Bonus Army included President Herbert Hoover himself, who feared that the immediate payments to veterans would further strain the already battered federal budget, as well as physical conservatives who were really just toting the whole physical policy thing. Another notable proponent of the Bonus Army was Douglas MacArthur, who is kind of a star in this whole story, as we'll get to later. He was a commander of the U.S. Army at the time. MacArthur labeled the Bonus Army as, and I quote, "traitors bent on overthrowing the government," and "declaring pacifism and its bedfellow communism are all around us," end quote. His government-sanctioned violence played a critical role in suppressing the Bonus Army's movement, and like I said, we'll get to that in just a moment. So on to our actual story. As the Great Depression was raging and millions of people were living in poverty, a group of veterans hosted a meeting in Portland, Oregon, in May of 1932. Around 250 to 400 veterans gathered together under the leadership of fellow veteran Walter M. Waters. He was inspired by the Patman Bill and proposed an idea that every man hopped on a freight and head for Washington, D.C. to get the money that was rightfully his. Inspired by Waters' words and mobilized by the Patman Bill, over 250 veterans, with about $30 collectively in their pockets, bonus certificates in one hand and the other holding a banner saying, "Portland Bonus March On to Washington," all started their march towards Union Pacific freight yards and will eventually make their way to D.C. The National Park describes it best, and I quote, "They began a long trek to Washington, brought a freight train loaned to them for free by the railroad authority. After exiting the train in Iowa, they hitched rides and walked the rest of the way to Washington. Smaller splinter groups reached to the Capitol on their own. By June 1st, some 1,500 men with their families were in Washington. The vets built Hoovervilles and shantytowns. Major sites included 12th Street and B Street in Northwest, now known as Constitution Avenue, 3rd Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest, and the largest of it all, 30-acre site on the Anacostia Flats. This was a private site and was dubbed Camp Bartlett, after its owner, John H. Bartlett, former Assistant Postmaster General and former Governor of New Hampshire, who let the veterans camp there for free." Smithsonian Magazine also paints such a beautiful picture of working class solidarity, and I quote, sympathetic railroad men, and many of them veterans themselves, eased the army's way eastwards. In town after town, well-wishers donated food, money, and moral support. Inspired by the Portland group, other bonus armies formed throughout the nation. Radio stations and local newspapers carried accounts of the growing contingent headed for their nation's capital. Their march was a spontaneous movement of protest arised in virtually every one of 48 states. Another one that I want to mention is a piece that I saw in the zinproject.org. And they mentioned that, quote, "While they may have fought in Europe as a segregated army, the men of the Bonus Army did not invite Jim Crow into this battle. Arriving from all around the country, alone or with wives and children, both black and white veterans huddled together. This was the Bonus Army, also known as the Bonus Expiratory Forces. The march and the encampments were more than a demand for an early payment. It was a cry for help and a demand that the government recognize the plight of its citizens and take concrete steps to alleviate their sufferings. These veterans, who had once fought for their country, were now fighting for survival, formed their own government." What was the Hoover administration's and the U.S. reaction to the Bonus Army? Well, their actions went down in history, and not in a good way. On June 15, 1932, in the middle of the Bonus Army's protest in D.C., the Patman Bill was passed by the House of Representatives by a vote of 211 to 176. But unfortunately, 2 days later, the Senate voted against the bill. When the Senate voted down the bill, it kind of ruined the morale of the movement. While some left, more veterans did continue to come to D.C. And mind you, this is D.C. during the summertime. It's not called a swamp for no reason. As the camps were growing, the main leaders of the Bonus Army, as you remembered, Walter Waters from Portland, became more and more concerned about the worsening sanitary conditions and the dwindling supplies of food in the camp. His concern was shared with government officials. Smithsonian Magazine describes, and quote, "Now more than ever, President Hoover, along with Douglas MacArthur and Secretary of War Patrick J. Hurley, feared that the Bonus Army would turn violent, perhaps triggering uprisings in Washington and elsewhere." And so this brings us to July 28, 1932, the day the music died. On July 28th, the police superintendent, G. Gladford, arrived at the shantytown off of Pennsylvania Avenue with 100 policemen. Mind you that earlier that month, Gladford asked Congress for thousands of dollars to feed the marchers. And now he was instructed to shut down the camps and evacuate everyone. In the morning of July 28th, cops attempted to evict about 50 marchers. As a show of solidarity, other demonstrators of the Bonus Army arrived at the camp. This triggered some violence between cops and protesters, but no shots were fired. Yet, even though the violence inflicted by cops and U.S. veterans was on full display, President Hoover ordered the U.S. Army and police to continue the evacuations. And by the afternoon, the situation escalated when the first shots were fired and a Bonus Army veteran was shot dead, another wounded, and three policemen were injured. U.S. Army troops armed with bayonets, tear gas, and tanks were instructed to evacuate the camps under the command of Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur's aide at the time, Major Dwight D. Eisenhower and George S. Patton, led the 3rd Cavalry, which spearheaded the eviction of the Bonus Army. Patton shared MacArthur's hatred for, quote, the Reds, and lectured his troops on how to deal with the Bonus Army, quote, "If you must fire, do a good job. A few casualties become martyrs. A large number, an objective lesson. When a mob starts to move, keep it on the run. Use bayonets to encourage its retreat. If you are running, a few good wounds in the buttocks will encourage them. If they resist, they must be killed." And this is about other U.S. veterans. Following these brutal instructions from Douglas MacArthur and friends, the troops stormed the Bonus Army's camps, employing tear gas and aggression against the veterans and their families. In the chaos, camps were set ablaze, and scenes of U.S. military troops moving against their own war veterans were captured by the news cameras, shocking and outraging the nation. The aggression did not stop even when Hoover ordered MacArthur to halt the operation at Anacostia Flats, aka Camp Bartlett, which again was private property. The only reason that Hoover instructed this was because he feared excessive force. Of course, MacArthur did not listen to the president's orders and continued the offensive, claiming that the Bonus Army intended to overthrow the U.S. government. By nightfall, the Bonus Army's camps were demolished, and thousands of disheartened and outraged veterans and their families were left homeless and dispersed. Zinn Project reports that two veterans lost their lives in the assault, and an 11-year-old died from what they believe to be gas-related illnesses. In addition, an 8-year-old boy was partially blind by gas, two police had their skulls fractured, and 1,000 veterans suffered gas-related injuries. All in all, the U.S. Army assault included 4 troops of cavalry, 4 companies of infantry, a machine gun squadron, and 6 tanks. Many Americans were shocked and dismayed to see American troops turn their weapons against their fellow citizens. The Washington Daily News editorialized and said, and I quote, "If the army must be called out to make war on unarmed citizens, this is no longer America." This is a tragic story, and I'd like for us to find something that we can learn from this about maybe the power of people, public opinions, the way that we, the people, can influence government policies and actions. The Bonus Army's resilience and determination laid the groundwork for future advocacy of veteran rights and benefits, showing that even in the face of this type of violent, violent oppression, peaceful protest and unity can and does lead to changes. For example, 4 years later, in 1936, Congress overrode Roosevelt's veto to pass the Adjusted Compensation Act, which allowed veterans to redeem their service certificates early. Then in 1944, the Servicemen's Readjustment Act passed, which marked a radical shift in the U.S. government's commitment to veterans, providing a range of benefits, including funds for education and training, loan guarantees for homes, farms, businesses, and unemployment pay. The Adjusted Act of 1952 further expanded education and training benefits to veterans of the Korean War. These are some of the benefits that are made available for service people and that they can still receive today. I'd like to make a point and clarify that not all veterans received that back in the day because, well, of racism and how it was codified into law. And it wasn't until after the civil rights that veterans were able to get a full spectrum of their benefits. And in more contemporary circumstances, there's still to this day some veterans that cannot receive their full benefits, whether it's stuff from the GI Bill or VA benefits due to gender, sexual orientation, immigration status, and pre-existing health condition. To learn more about this nuanced subject, please go check out my episode titled Don't Ask, Don't Tell with Nathaniel Bamey. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really appreciate you taking the time and listening to the story. I just really think it's important to capture moments in history that can really speak and inspire us now. And although it is kind of sad to hear the way that things worked out, we can definitely be inspired and remember that we're standing on the, you know, shoulders of giants. My name is Tammy. This is Popular Education Radio. If you'd like to check me out, please feel free to send an email, populareducationradio@gmail.com, or check us out on the Instagram at Popular Education Radio. Please rate this podcast, share it with your friends. The more that you share, the more that it reaches out to people, and hopefully y'all can start talking with each other about cool history. Anyways, thank you so much. I'll see you next time.